Thank you for choosing to take a self-guided tour with Free Tours by Foot. We believe in operating quality tours that are affordable to everybody, regardless of budget, and we hope that you enjoy your tour with us today. You have chosen to come along on our City of London self-guided tour, a walk that will take you through 2,000 years of London's history. This tour will see you wandering down medieval alleyways, uncovering hidden gems off the beaten track, passing through the financial heart of the United Kingdom, and finishing with a stroll along the beautiful River Thames. On the tour today, you can expect to walk nearly 2 miles, or just over 3 kilometers. The tour will last, on average, just under 2 hours, although this may change depending on your walking pace or stops you wish to make along the way. For guests with mobility issues, or those with prams or buggies, there is only one set of steps on the route, and these are easily avoided by a small reroute, which we will explain in detail at the time. If at any point you wish to explore a location further, please do. And if at any point you wish to stop at a pub and have a pint, please do that too. To get to the first stop on your tour, please step outside of Temple Station and turn to the left. Walk up the stairs directly onto Arundel Street. Follow the street up the hill until you reach the traffic lights on your right. Cross over diagonally to the courtyard of the church across the road with the 3 statues in front. This is your first stop. You are now standing outside St. Clement Danes Church, designed and built by architect Christopher Wren. Completed in 1682, this used to be the local neighborhood church, but today there is no real neighborhood left in this part of town. Throughout your entire tour with us today, you will only pass a handful of residential buildings. Instead, you will be seeing universities, embassies, law courts, banks, and business after business. Today, St. Clement Danes Church has become the official site of worship for the Royal Air Force, a usage that dates back to shortly after the Second World War. During World War II, London was bombed extensively by the German Air Force in a series of events known as the Blitz. Throughout the Blitz, many of London's historical buildings were ruined beyond repair, entire neighborhoods were wiped off the map, and thousands of people lost their lives. St. Clement Danes was struck by bombs during the Blitz, and the interior of the church was totally destroyed by fire. The outside of the building remained intact enough that it was decided to try to preserve the church rather than to tear it down, a fate which befell dozens of other churches during the Blitz. The Royal Air Force decided to start a campaign to collect donations in an attempt to repair the damage that had been done here, and soon their association with the church became so strong that the Air Force declared it their official site of worship. You will notice the signs outside of the entrance of the church that refer to this, and also the 2 statues out front depicting wartime Royal Air Force leaders Arthur Harris and Hugh Dowding. If you now move to the left side of the church, you will see quite a bit of damage to the building, and all this damage you will see comes from the Blitz. The Air Force made the decision not to repair this damage, and today it stands as a memorial and a reminder of what happened here in London during the bombings of the Second World War. This is a statue of the 18th century London celebrity Samuel Johnson. In this statue, Johnson is posed holding a book and speaking out loud, exactly as he would have looked during his lifetime here in London. Initially, Johnson became famous for his public speaking and quotations, and throughout his life, Johnson would be known for his intelligence, wit, and humor. Later in life, he would gain notoriety through his efforts to put together the first ever comprehensive English dictionary. Johnson is also the one who penned a famous love letter to London, including his famous quote, "When a man is tired of London, he is tired of life," something that we definitely think is true. With your back to Johnson's statue, continue down the step onto the traffic island to see the building, which is now on your left. You are now facing the Royal Courts of Justice, the highest civil court in the United Kingdom. This structure was completed in the 1870s, and to modern-day viewers, this building is quite over-the-top, elaborate, and highly decorated. It's a perfect example of what we call neo-Gothic architecture. For the Victorians in the 19th century, this style of building was completely standard, not considered fancy or special in any way, and there are 2 reasons why the Victorians used this style of architecture so often. Firstly, the Victorians were the first generation in Britain who ever had the idea that you would want to preserve historical buildings for enjoyment in the future. Before the 1800s, tearing down a 500-year-old building was considered of no consequence to anybody. However, in their sudden desire to save as many old buildings as possible, the Victorians then developed a really bad habit of building everything new to look a lot older than it actually was. Secondly, throughout the Victorian era, the stories of Camelot, King Arthur, the Knights of the Round Table, and Merlin were incredibly popular, and Queen Victoria was a known fan of these legends. Victoria believed that she embodied all the admirable characteristics of the Knights of the Round Table, and she decorated her entire robing room in the Palace of Westminster with statues and paintings depicting the legends of the adventures of Arthur and his knights. For architects who were submitting their designs for Queen Victoria's approval, they knew that if they used the Gothic architecture associated with the medieval time period that Arthur was supposed to have lived in, then the Queen would be more than likely to approve of their designs. This led to architects all over the country building everything, churches, houses, courtrooms, and stately homes, all to look like medieval palaces. This wave of faux medieval construction created this neo-Gothic type of architecture. Now cross the street away from the Royal Courts of Justice towards the Twinings Tea Shop across the street. Facing Twinings, with the Royal Courts of Justice behind you, head left down the Strand. Stop outside of the monument in the center of the road with the dragon on the top. In the middle of the street stands a monument with a dragon sitting on the top. The two figures displayed on the sides are Queen Victoria and her son, Prince Albert, the future King Edward VII. This structure is known as Temple Bar, and Temple Bar is the marker that shows us the boundaries of the City of London. This means you are now technically leaving the City of Westminster and entering the City of London. Strictly speaking, the City of London is only 1 square mile, starting here and finishing at the Tower of London. Colloquially, residents tend to refer to the square mile simply as the City, and we will do the same. When thinking of London in a historical context, it's worth remembering that for centuries, the City of London was London. When the Romans controlled Britain, their trading port of Londinium flourished in this area of town, stretching down onto the banks of the River Thames. Medieval London was also nearly entirely restricted to this square mile, and it wasn't until the 18th century, with a booming population and the expansions of the Industrial Revolution taking place, that London began to spill outside of the original boundaries, into places such as Westminster and Kensington, areas that had previously been home only to members of the royal family and wealthy landowners. Today, the City of London operates entirely differently from the rest of the capital. Although the square mile has a resident population of only 9,000 people, compared to the nearly 10 million citizens who live in the rest of London, it has a daily workforce of an estimated 400,000, who all commute into the city every day. To look after all these people, commerce, and business, the City of London has their own individual organizations and offices that operate here. For example, the city has their own mayor, known as the Right Honourable Lord Mayor, only responsible for this part of town and with no power elsewhere in the capital. The Lord Mayor is a completely different person from the Mayor of London, who is responsible for the rest of the city. Also, London has a police force known as the Metropolitan Police, but the City of London have their own separate police force known as the City of London Police. From this point on, the rest of the tour takes place within the square mile of the ancient City of London, a centre of trade, commerce, industry, finance, and life that it has existed on the same site for over the last 2,000 years. Continue your walk down the Strand, which is now called Fleet Street since you have entered the city. When you get to the brown and white Tudor building on your right, stop to take a look. Across the street stands Prince Henry's Room, constructed in the year 1610. This building is an incredible original structure because it has survived not only the Blitz, but also the Great Fire of London in 1666, which we will talk about later. Originally, this building operated as a pub, and today it belongs to the Lord Mayor's office. It also highlights an architectural feature that used to be incredibly common, but that doesn't really exist anymore. You will notice that the taller the building gets, the further out over the road it starts to come. In medieval London, almost all buildings were constructed this way, but even more dramatically. In fact, back then, by the time you got to the top of your house, you could lean out your window and shake hands with the person in the building across the street. Structures were designed this way for two good reasons. Firstly, in centuries gone by, housing taxes and property taxes were calculated based on the ground floor of a building, so a smaller ground floor meant paying less tax, however big the rest of your building happened to be. Secondly, the idea of a rubbish bin or a toilet hadn't been around for long, and centuries ago people would throw rubbish and toilets straight out of the windows without even thinking twice. You can imagine that if you were living on the first floor, you wouldn't want the second floor dropping their rubbish onto your head or splashing their toilets into your windows. So the gradual extension of the building moving upwards and outwards meant that everything being tossed out the window dropped onto the ground below, or onto the people who happened to be walking underneath it at the time. Should the door under Prince Henry's room be open, you can walk through it and go straight ahead until you see the church on your left. If you are doing this walk on a weekend, it is still possible to get to Temple Church, although it's a bit more difficult. Continue down the Strand until you get to Bovary Street on your right. Walk down until you get to Tudor Street. Take a right and enter the car park. If you look across the car park, up and slightly to the right, you will see a red brick building that houses a small private cafe. A few doors up from that building is the entrance to a small alleyway. Temple Church is just through that opening. You will need to retrace your steps to get back to the top of Bovary Street to continue the tour. Temple Church was originally built in the 1160s, when the Order of the Knights Templar purchased the land here so that they could create a monastic complex to act as their headquarters in England, and it was here that the initiation ceremonies of the Knights Templar would take place. The structure of the church is divided into two, the original nave called the Round Church and an adjoining rectangular building called the Chancel. The design of the church was based on the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem and contains the first ever freestanding Purbeck marble columns in existence. The church was officially consecrated on the 10th of February 1185 and was first refurbished 100 years later when it underwent extensive renovation under the command of King Henry III, and one of his sons is still interred here inside the church. Henry's grandson, King Edward II, seized control of the church and sold it on, and the church eventually fell into the hands of a college of lawyers, founding the modern-day Inns of Court that are still based here, Inner Temple and Middle Temple. Renovated and repaired in the 20th century after damage caused by the Blitz, Temple Church now sports stone and architectural features spanning over the centuries of its existence. In fact, effigies of the Knights Templar dating back to the 13th century are still contained within the nave, and these sit alongside structures built as recently as the 1950s. Today, Temple Church is an active house of worship and holds regular services on Sundays. Organ music and choir recitals are held here, which the public can attend. In fact, the Temple Choir is a well-known and respected institution. The All-Mayor Choir, made up of 18 boys, not only performs, but also broadcasts and records their records. Now walk back out and return onto Fleet Street and turn right. Continue along the road until you cross over Bovary Street, which is on your right. Just past this street are a set of traffic lights. Turn left and cross here. Walk up Bolt Court, the small alleyway in between the McDonald's and the Starbucks. Continue up, bear to the right, and then turn left past the metal bicycle stands until you get to a group of benches and a statue of a cat. At the bottom of the courtyard here stands Samuel Johnson's house, and it is in this house that he was living when he wrote his dictionary. But while he was here, Johnson was not alone. He lived with his manservant and a whole host of cats, one of whom is commemorated in this statue. In the 18th century, most people did not keep cats as pets, and Johnson was considered a bit of an eccentric to have kept them himself. But although Johnson had many cats, one was his favorite, a big black tomcat named Hodge, and this statue depicts Hodge. Unveiled in 1997, the statue shows Hodge sitting on top of the dictionary, looking to his old house and sitting in front of a couple oyster shells. The oyster shells are here as a reference to the fact that Hodge lived on a diet made exclusively of oysters. To us today, oysters are an expensive delicacy, but in the 1700s, oysters were plentiful around England's coast and incredibly easy to source, which meant that they became a staple food of the poor. In fact, oysters were so cheap that it was considered embarrassing if you were so poor that you needed to eat them. For this reason, Johnson felt it would be cruel to ask his staff to go out and buy oysters for his cat, which meant Samuel would buy them himself. It was considered truly scandalous for a man of Johnson's wealth and status to be seen in public buying oysters, especially oysters for a cat. With Johnson's house and Hodge behind you, go right, back down past the metallic bicycle stands. But instead of going back the way you came, turn left. You will pass one pathway on the right, then come to a dead end with another alleyway on the right. That is where you'll spot the sign for our next stop, the Old Cheshire Cheese. This is the Old Cheshire Cheese, one of the oldest and best-known pubs in London. Originally, a pub was built on this site in the 1500s, which means Londoners have been able to get a drink here for nearly the last 5 centuries. Unfortunately, though, this is not the original Cheshire Cheese. The original was lost in the Great Fire of London in 1666, which destroyed nearly all of the medieval city. And this reconstruction was erected less than a year later, in 1667, which makes this one of the first buildings to be totally reconstructed after the fire, showing that everybody had put their priorities into the right place. The pub gained notoriety throughout the country as a popular haunt of numerous well-known figures throughout the centuries. Charles Dickens, P.G. Woodhouse, Dr. Johnson, Mark Twain, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle are all known to have been regulars. In fact, Dickens references the pub in A Tale of Two Cities, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is thought to have set a scene in The Case of the Red-Headed League at the pub. Walking into the pub is like walking back in time. The Cheshire Cheese is filled with wooden fixtures, sloping floors, crooked doorways, and bumpy ceilings. It's a true, authentic, historical London pub, and we recommend stopping for a drink now, if you've got the time. Now walk down the alley past the Old Cheshire Cheese. You'll come back out onto Fleet Street. Turn left and walk until you get to the red post box showing the initials of Queen Victoria. Here, carefully cross the Fleet, then turn left. You will walk over a road called Salisbury Court on your right and continue on, then turn right into the next court known as Bride's. This is the Church of St. Bride's, another Christopher Wren creation. Opened in 1672, St. Bride's was the tallest building in London for a brief period, and is now the second tallest Christopher Wren church in London. The church is known as the Journalists' Church, as Fleet Street was previously the home of the press, and many writers and reporters would have worshipped here. However, today the church is primarily known for an urban legend that has grown up around it, a legend you can decide if you believe or not. The story goes that in the early 1700s, there was a baker living in London who was getting married. Feeling creative, he decided to design and bake his wedding cake to look like the top of St. Bride's Church. It was such a success at the wedding that word began to spread, and pretty soon everybody in London was asking for wedding cakes that looked like St. Bride's. And that's why, today, traditional wedding cakes are big at the bottom with smaller and smaller tiers as you go up, because they've been modeled after this. Or not. Facing the church, turn left and walk down St. Bride's Avenue, the alleyway between the office buildings here and the church. At the bottom of the avenue, you'll walk downstairs, then turn left onto Bride Lane. When you come back onto Fleet Street, turn right until you get to the large junction with New Bridge Street. In the same direction, cross the street, past the co-op store, and continue up the hill. At the top of that hill is St. Paul's Cathedral. You're now standing outside St. Paul's Cathedral, Sir Christopher Wren's masterpiece. The church you are looking at dates from the late 17th to early 18th centuries, but there has been a church dedicated to St. Paul on this site since as far back as the 7th century, which makes this only the most recent in a long line of St. Paul's churches. This church was declared officially open by Parliament on Christmas Day in the year 1711, which was in the reign of Queen Anne, who you will see depicted outside. Today, St. Paul's is one of the most recognizable sites in London, and Wren's Dome, the second largest church dome in the world, is a key part of the city's skyline. Since its construction, the cathedral has played a huge part in London's history. It has hosted royal weddings, such as that of Charles, the Prince of Wales, and Lady Diana Spencer in the 1980s, and it played host to the official Diamond Jubilee Thanksgiving services for Queen Victoria in 1897 and Queen Elizabeth II in 2012. And it has also featured both the 80th and 90th birthday celebrations for Her Majesty. The cathedral has also hosted less happy occasions, such as the funerals of Lord Nelson, the Duke of Wellington, Margaret Thatcher, and Christopher Wren. In fact, along with over 200 burials, the Duke of Wellington, Lord Nelson, and Christopher Wren are among those who are interred inside. However, Christopher Wren has a very simplistic memorial, nothing like the grand tomb and statues you may imagine. Wren's burial place is marked by a simple plaque inscribed with the words, quote, "Reader, if you seek his monument, look around you." Today, St. Paul's is a working church and can be visited for either tourism or worship. Guests can buy tickets to go inside and climb to the top of the dome, Or they can pay a visit for free as a worshiper, coming to attend any of the daily services here at the church. Visiting for worship doesn't give you access to walk through the cathedral, but if you are traveling on a very tight budget, it's a great way to get inside and sit down where the guests did at Charles and Diana's wedding without having to spend any money to do it. Standing between the statue of Queen Anne and St. Paul's itself, facing the church, go to the right and follow the pathway along the side of the cathedral. Continue to walk right beside St. Paul's until you get to the red phone box just beyond the back end of the church. As we come to the back of St. Paul's, the architecture of the area starts to shift. Here you will notice the slow decline of stone buildings and properties squeezed in close together, and you will start to see the glass, steel, and skyscrapers that dominate this part of the city. In fact, generally speaking, the further east you go in London, the more severe the damage was during the Blitz, which means these days, the further east you go, the fewer original buildings still stand. In fact, from this single position, every building that surrounds you in any direction dates from after the Second World War, except St. Paul's Cathedral. During the Blitz, St. Paul's was struck twice, firstly on the 10th of October in 1940, and secondly on the 17th of April in 1941. In fact, some of the most famous images from the Blitz depict the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral rising out of the fire, smoke, and destruction of the buildings surrounding it. However, generally speaking, St. Paul's largely survived the Blitz, perhaps because, as many historians believe, St. Paul's was not a target for the German Air Force. This is because St. Paul's was previously one of the very few London landmarks that was visible from the air, so the German Air Force may have gone out of their way to protect it so that they could use it as they were flying over London to figure out where they were going. The reason the eastern side of the City of London and the western areas of the capital fared so differently during the war is because the east end of London was a much larger target than the west, for numerous reasons. Firstly, just geographically, the aircraft dropping the bombs were traveling from the east to the west, which for the lucky people in the west sometimes meant that there was no more ammunition left by the time the planes got there. Secondly, London's wartime infrastructure, such as the ammunition factories, dockyards, and warehouses, were all based in the east, which meant bombings in this area were incredibly frequent. And lastly, it is worth mentioning that in the 1930s and 40s, London's Jewish population was based almost exclusively in the East End, rendering the East a much larger target than the West. With St. Paul's behind you, walk past St. Augustine on your left and continue down the pedestrian path here until you get to the street, New Change. Cross the road and keep the modern office building on your left. You will pass a tea shop called Bees of Bloomsbury and come to Bread Street Kitchen on the corner. At the end of Bread Street Kitchen, turn left onto Bread Street itself. Walk down and you have passed the restaurant on the right-hand side called Burger and Lobster. Just to the side of the restaurant is an alleyway called John Milton Passage. Go down the alleyway into the churchyard. You are now standing in the courtyard of St. Mary Le Bow, the church whose bells are said to determine whether or not one is born as a Cockney. The legend states that a true Cockney must be born with an earshot of the sound of the Bow bells. These are also the bells that are said to have brought Dick Whittington back to London to reclaim his title as the Lord Mayor. Today, however, we'd like to draw your attention to the statue in the middle of the courtyard. This is a statue of Captain John Smith, most famously known for his appearance in the Disney animated film Pocahontas. Smith was a real person and involved in a lot of the businesses in this part of town. However, for the purposes of your tour today, we'd like you to focus on a piece of art below John's left foot. Here you will see two dragons and a shield. The dragons here represent the City of London and are reminiscent of the dragon on top of Temple Bar that you saw at the start of the tour. The shield boasts the Red Cross of St. George, patron saint of England, and the Red Sword of St. Paul, patron saint of London. Altogether here is the coat of arms of the City of London, and the first recorded use of this design comes from the year 1350. You may have noticed this design already on your tour, as throughout the City of London it appears on all the road signs, traffic barriers, and even the rubbish bins. This means it's easy to tell whether or not you are within the boundaries of the City of London just by spotting this design as you look around you. You will now begin a walk down Cheapside, and cheap is an old English word that means market. In medieval London, this was the Market Street, the widest, busiest street in town. Although the market has been gone for over 3 centuries now, it is still possible to tell what was being sold at the market and from where it was being sold because of the names of all the roads and streets in this part of town. Already on the tour, you have walked down Bread Street and past Milk Lane. Cheapside later turns into Poultry further down the road, and you will also pass Honey Lane, Fish Street Hill, and Pudding Lane as your tour continues. With St. Mary Le Bow to your right and the statue of John Smith behind you, turn right onto Cheapside. As you walk, you will walk across Queen Street. Keep going, and when you get to the large junction with Mansion House Street, turn, taking the crossing near the right. Immediately as you cross over, you will see a small courtyard with a mansion on the left and the magistrate's court on your right. This is Walbrook. Keep going forward until you reach number 12. We have already discussed how the City of London sits on top of the Roman city of Londinium, and here is your opportunity to see it firsthand in one of archaeology's biggest ever finds in the capital. Beneath this modern office building, the European headquarters of Bloomberg, sits the remains of a Roman temple dating from around AD 240. Uncovered originally as part of a bomb site during the Blitz, the temple has now been fully restored and placed near to what would have been its original site. The temple now also houses an astonishing exhibition of Roman artifacts that had been discovered throughout the years in this part of London. The Roman temple that stood here was dedicated to the Roman god Mithra originally, and was later dedicated to Bacchus, the god of wine, before being abandoned in the 4th century. The location of this temple was strategically planned as, in centuries gone by, two small offshoots of the River Thames flowed into this area, which meant this was an easily accessible place for locals and visitors, who would travel from across the empire, to access. The temple remains lie underground today, and, strangely, would also have been built underground originally. Visitors would descend a staircase into a candlelit hall filled with dark corners, smoke, and perfume. The entrance to the temple was deliberately kept unsettling, as new members of the temple would undergo a terrifying initiation ceremony where they believed they were going to be killed. The ambience has been recreated here, and a slow descent into the temple transports visitors back centuries. The temple is currently open 6 days a week, closed on Mondays, and is free to visit, but you must book a time slot in advance to guarantee your entry. To book a ticket and view the opening hours, simply visit their website at www.londonmithraeum.com. That's www.londonmithraeum.com. You are now standing in the financial center of London, and you are surrounded by some of the most fiscally important buildings in the country, as well as branches and offices from banks and businesses from all across the globe. The most important building here is the one you are currently standing in front of, with the white columns in front and the white flag on the top, the Royal Exchange. Founded in 1571 and opened by Queen Elizabeth I, the Royal Exchange was designed to be the center of commerce for the City of London. Eventually, all of the buying, the selling, and the trading that was happening inside would eventually help to form both the Bank of England and the London Stock Exchange. This means London's position as a global financial power began right here. It is worth mentioning, however, that this is not the original building. The original structure was lost during the Great Fire of London, the second version caught fire in 1838, and the current version was constructed in 1844. This is only the outer structure, however. The inside of the building was renovated as recently as the year 2002. Today, it is a luxury retail center featuring shops, cafes, and restaurants. In front of the Royal Exchange sits a statue of the Duke of Wellington on horseback, facing away from the building. He is looking to a structure across the street with columns in front and a triangular portico on top. This is Mansion House, the home of the Lord Mayor of London. This building was designed by architects George Dance and completed in the 1750s. The carvings above the columns on the front of the house depict the somewhat disturbing image of a female figure representing the City of London trampling on all of her enemies. It is also worth mentioning at this point that no Lord Mayor can serve more than 1 year at a time, so the occupancy of this house changes on a yearly basis every November when the new Lord Mayor takes his or her position. Across the road, the structure with the giant wall is the Bank of England. This is the world's second oldest central bank, dating from 1694. The current version of the building dates from after the Second World War, as the Bank of England suffered so much damage during the Blitz that essentially the entire thing was reconstructed. At any given point, this wall that surrounds the bank is between 8 to 11 feet thick and extends below the ground a further 7 stories. Under the ground behind these walls sits the vaults of the Bank of England. Today, the Bank of England stores around 400,000 bars of gold, equivalent to 5,134 tons. The value of this gold is estimated at £142 billion and makes up 3% of all the gold that has ever been mined throughout human history. Now stand with both the Royal Exchange and the statue of the Duke of Wellington behind you. You'll be facing Mansion House. You want to cross the street that is to your left and walk onto Lombard Street. Take the first left, which is still called Lombard Street, and stop near the Sainsbury's in Pret, near Abchurch Lane. Londoners have a habit of naming buildings after the items we think they look like, such as the gherkin or the cheese grater, and the walkie-talkie is another to add to the list. A commercial skyscraper in the City of London, the actual name of this building is 20 Fenchurch Street. The distinctive shape of the structure, which is larger at the top than at the bottom, has led to the nickname walkie-talkie. The building had originally been a hotly debated construction, with many believing the walkie-talkie had negatively impacted the views of the City of London, St. Paul's Cathedral, and the Tower of London. In fact, the building was originally intended to be another 40 metres, or 131 feet, taller, but was shortened as a compromise. And at the top of the walkie-talkie sits the Sky Garden. Spreading across three floors, the Sky Garden offers uninterrupted views of London. There's a landscaped garden as well as a bar and restaurant. Although it costs to drink and dine at the venue, the garden itself is actually free to the public as part of an agreement made before planning permission from the building was granted. Some think the word garden is a bit generous when used to describe this part of the building, so expecting lush green grass and countless plants, flowers, or trees will leave visitors disappointed. However, the plants and trees that are on display here are lovely and give a somewhat surreal feeling while standing so high above the ground. And for the price, particularly when compared to the London Eye or the Shard, this is definitely one of the best views in all of London. It may be that you have heard of the walkie-talkie building before, as back in the summer of 2013, the building made international headlines because of a very interesting event, the melting of a car. The unique shape of the structure means that for around 2 hours a day, the sun shines directly onto the concave windows of the walkie-talkie, reflecting onto the streets to the south. It is estimated that the glare reflecting off the windows is around 6 times brighter than direct sunlight. This reflection was so strong, in fact, that it damaged vehicles parked on the road nearby, including the partial melting of the framework of a Jaguar car. Please take note that although the Sky Garden is free to visit, you must book a space online in advance. Continue down Lombard Street, past the Pret and the Sainsbury's. Take the first right onto Abchurch Lane and walk down until you get to King William Street. At the bottom of King William Street is a large junction. Go down the stairs to your left. At the bottom of the stairs is the entrance to the House of Fraser on your left and more stairs to your right. Go down the stairs on your right. Walk until you can turn left. There will then be stairs on your left and right with the entrance to the Tube station directly in front of you. Take the stairs on the right. Once you get to the top of the stairs, keep walking until you can see the monument on your left. Reaching up into the sky here stands the monument to the Great Fire of London. We have referenced this fire a few times on the tour, and here we'd like to give you more information. At around 1 o'clock in the morning on the 2nd of September in 1666, in a bakery on nearby Pudding Lane, a small fire broke out. Eventually, this fire would grow and spread, demolishing the entire medieval city of London and rendering an estimated 70,000 of the 80,000 people living here completely homeless. Although incredibly destructive, the fire has, for many years, not thought to have been very deadly. In fact, some historians' accounts claim that the death toll from the fire could be as few as 6 people. Some historians believe this to be the case because London was a crowded city built entirely out of wood, which meant these fires happened all the time. So when citizens heard word that another fire had broken out, nobody panicked, as they had all seen fires before, and the calm evacuation of the city would have led to few fatalities. However, some historians refute this, stating that the casualties may have been higher, but as many of the deaths were those of middle class or poor people, they were not considered important and were therefore never recorded. Regardless of the death toll, the Great Fire of London was unlike any fire the city had seen before. It would burn uncontrolled throughout the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th of September before finally being contained. However, the fire wouldn't be completely put out throughout the entire city for quite some time. In fact, Samuel Pepys, a man living in London at the time, commented that one could still see smoke coiling out of people's basements as long as 3 weeks after the fire was over. Pepys also gives us a somewhat amusing view into Londoners' attitudes towards the fire. He wrote that when his friends arrived to tell him a fire had broken out, he rushed home, grabbed his biggest wheel of cheese, his most expensive bottle of wine, then he dug a hole in his garden and buried them both. Once he knew his valuables were safe, he then strode to the pub to watch the fire with his friends. This account may lend some truth to the theory that Londoners did not experience any kind of mass panic while the fire was raging. The monument itself was designed by Christopher Wren and opened to the public in 1677. The structure comprises a 202-foot column topped with a viewing platform and a golden flaming pudding, a reference to the fact that the fire began on Pudding Lane. The 202-foot tall column was built at this height specifically because if you were to tip it over, the top of it would touch the spot on Pudding Lane where the Great Fire is thought to have begun. The column's height also makes it the tallest freestanding stone column in the entire world. Guests who make the climb all the way to the top may be surprised to find that when they get back down, they will be awarded an official certificate that congratulates them for having made the 311-step climb. With the monument on your left, cross Monument Street and continue down King William Street. Shortly after the bus stop on your right, before the road you are on crosses the river, you will see a set of stairs going down on the left. Go down the stairs all the way, and you will find yourself standing underneath the bridge at the bottom of the steps. Turn right and walk a little way down the path and face the river, so that when you look to your right, you can see the stairs you have just walked down, and you look down to your left, you can see the columns of Tower Bridge a little further down the river. Here you are positioned between the two most famous, but confusing bridges in the entire world. The name London Bridge is famous all throughout the globe, and the bridge here, with the two columns on top, is one of the most photographed sites in London, which leads many visitors to assume that this is London Bridge. That is wrong, however, as the ornate grey and blue structure is Tower Bridge. London Bridge is the cement bridge opposite. Historically speaking, London Bridge is incredibly important. There has been a crossing at the River Thames here since at least the year AD 43. The medieval bridge that stood here was more of a road across the river rather than a bridge. It boasted houses, pubs, and even churches. The bridge held so much on top that it routinely crumbled under its own weight. Hence, we believe, comes the rhyme, London Bridge is falling down. And the Victorian London Bridge was, somewhat famously, put up for sale in the 1950s and bought by a man in the United States, who paid for it to be flown out to the state of Arizona, where it was then rebuilt on a golf course in the town of Lake Havasu, where it still stands today. Which bizarrely means if you would like to see the Victorian London Bridge, you have to travel to the United States to do it. Now, still facing the river, turn left and continue walking along the river path. You can play the following clip as you walk. Rocketing into the sky on your right is one of the newer additions to London's skyline, the Shard. As of recording, the Shard is the tallest building in the European Union, boasting 95 floors and standing at 309 meters, or 1,016 feet tall. The Shard was completed in 2013, and there is a viewing gallery at the top that's open to visitors, although tickets do not come cheap, with an adult ticket over £25. Also contained within the building are multiple office spaces, a hotel, and numerous bars and restaurants. Although they are not located at the very top of the building, the restaurants and bars inside are high up enough to provide an excellent view of the city, and tickets are not required for entry. As you continue along the river, still looking to your right, you will see a sandy-colored building with a large black archway in the middle. This is Hayes Galleria. Dating from the 1850s, this building used to be called Hayes Wharf, and the large archway is where ships would have pulled in to unload their goods into the surrounding buildings. Hayes Wharf was well-positioned and well-used, becoming one of the chief delivery points for ships bringing tea into the country's capital. At the peak of its usage, it's estimated that 80% of dry goods imported into London passed through this wharf. Today, it has been modernized and transformed into a series of offices, shops, restaurants, and pubs. Continuing along, just to the left of Hayes Galleria, you will see a large warship. This is the HMS Belfast, a ship commissioned in 1938 to meet a demand from the British Navy, who were seeking the creation of, quote, a 9,000-ton cruiser sufficiently armed to withstand a direct hit from an 8-inch shell, capable of 32 knots and mounting 12 6-inch guns. HMS Belfast would eventually play a key role in the D-Day invasion of Normandy, when the ship was made the headquarters of the Bombardment Force E. Winston Churchill reportedly wished to stand on deck of the HMS Belfast to observe the landings at Normandy, but was convinced by King George VI to stay in the United Kingdom. The ship later saw service in the Korean War and was then paid off into reserve in 1963 and was due to be scrapped a few years later, in 1971. However, one of HMS Belfast's former captains, Rear Admiral Sir Morgan Morgan-Giles, campaigned that the vessel should be saved and preserved for the nation. His campaign was a success, and today the ship is proudly moored here and is open to the public all year round. If you turn your back to the Shard and the HMS Belfast, you'll be facing a large sandy-colored building with many windows. If you look to the roof of the structure, you will see carvings of fish and golden weather vanes with a similar motif. These are all clues to the building's origin as a fish market. Known as Billingsgate Market, in its heyday of the 19th century, this was the largest fish market in the entire world. In the 1980s, a new fish market was built in the Docklands area to the east, called New Billingsgate, and this building was retired from use and renamed Old Billingsgate. Briefly, this building fell into disuse, and the story goes that this was because no company would ever wish to purchase Old Billingsgate as usable office space, because no matter how many times the building is cleaned, it will always smell of fish. Whether or not you believe this, today the building is a well-known events venue and various functions take place here on and off throughout the year. Here, the path ends with a perfect view towards Tower Bridge. Constructed in 1894, Tower Bridge is a suspension bridge and a World Heritage Site measuring 244 meters, 800 feet long, and 65 meters, 264 feet high, and provides a roadway across the Thames for over 40,000 people a day, both on foot and wheels. The bridge is another excellent example of Victorian neo-Gothic architecture. Although the bridge is less than 150 years old, it is designed to look medieval in appearance, thus contributing somewhat to the confusion that leaves people believing this is a centuries-old London bridge. Tower Bridge was opened to the public in the 1890s, and originally it was intended that horses and carriages should go on the bottom, and pedestrians should climb and use the walkways at the top. As you may imagine, many Victorians didn't want the hassle of climbing up so many stairs, which meant the walkways were hardly used. This made them a very attractive haunt for thieves and prostitutes, who turned them into gambling dens and areas of vice before the police cleared them out in the early 20th century. Today, they hold part of the Tower Bridge exhibition. Guests wishing to visit the exhibition will have the opportunity to get inside the structure and also into the engine rooms to see how the bridge operates. And not for those who are afraid of heights, the suspended walkways have recently been refurbished to include glass panels along their floors, so guests can see right down all 42 meters to the river below. Tower Bridge is still an operating drawbridge to this day and can be open for river traffic. On average, Tower Bridge opens 1,000 times a year, which means there's a very good chance you may get to see it opening while you are here. Ships have to request a bridge lift at least 24 hours in advance, which means it is possible to time it right to make sure you see a lift. To guarantee a view of the bridge opening and closing, simply check out their website, www.towerbridge.org.uk. There you will find a full schedule of lift times to ensure you get to see the bridge at work. We'd recommend arriving 10 minutes before the scheduled lift time, as occasionally ships come in a bit ahead of schedule. From where you are standing, looking at Tower Bridge, you will notice on the left a long path running along the river with a blue fence. Head along that path. At the end, you will turn left, past the building or building works on your right, and then turn right at the end of the path onto Lower Thames Street. Follow that street until the end, which brings you to the Tower of London. Whilst facing the Tower of London, turn to the left and walk somewhat diagonally forward until you see the large stone steps that you can stand or sit on. You have now arrived at your final stop of the City of London tour, Her Majesty's Fortress, the Tower of London. The first thing you will likely notice about the Tower of London is that it is not a tower. In fact, it's a series of 21 towers, turrets, walls, and buildings. Originally, however, there was just a single tower here, known as the White Tower, or the Keep. That's the tower you can see with the flagpole on the top. This tower was built in 1071 by William the Conqueror, who had conquered England back in 1066. At that time, most visitors came to London using the River Thames, so William's idea was to build a huge stone tower here so that as people came into town, they would immediately see how rich and powerful he was. But as the years have gone on, the tower has changed, evolved, and grown to the size you see it today. Throughout its evolution, the tower has also been used for many things. It's been a fortress and a palace, it was the mint where all of our money was manufactured for centuries, and before London Zoo existed, all the animals owned by the crown were kept here. In fact, Henry II in the 12th century had a pet polar bear that lived here, and he would tie a cord around its wrist and let it go fishing in the Thames. Many Londoners would come down here specifically to see the bear swimming around in the water. The tower was also, quite famously, a prison. Notable prisoners that were kept here include people such as Sir Walter Raleigh, Sir Francis Drake, Sir Thomas More, Lady Jane Grey, Henry VIII's second wife, Anne Boleyn, his fifth wife, Catherine Howard, and his youngest daughter, Elizabeth I, who was locked away here by her sister when she was a young princess. Most of the prisoners kept in the tower were kept in the rooms that face the big stone steps you are now standing on. This is because the site of the execution scaffold stood nearby, so the windows here would give the prisoners a perfectly framed view of their final destination. This means that the majority of executions were held outside the walls of the tower, not behind them. Even though the tower has a bloody reputation, up until the 20th century, very few people were actually executed inside. This is because executions were seen as a public event. Queens and kings would want to flex their muscles and show their power by executing people where everybody could see, so executions behind the walls of the tower were quite rare. Executions inside the tower complex would only take place if the person being executed had committed a crime considered embarrassing to the royal family, such as when Henry VIII's fifth wife was suspected of having an affair, and if the soon-to-be executed prisoner had royal blood, which would entitle them to a private execution. As you face the Tower of London, you will see that there is a path at the bottom of the steps that runs around the tower. Walk left and follow this path until it takes you underneath the road. Straight ahead, you will see a set of steps. After the first flight of steps, if you look to the right, you can see a piece of the original London Roman Wall. This unassuming wall of stone is one of the last remaining pieces of Roman Londinium. The initial construction of the wall seems to have begun in the late 2nd or early 3rd centuries and continued until at least the end of the 4th. Why the Romans built this wall is unknown, perhaps to protect the city from invading native tribes. Originally, the wall would have surrounded London on three sides, with the River Thames being the fourth barrier. Inside the wall would have been five gateways located throughout that coincided and aligned with Roman roads into and out of the city. In centuries to come, the Roman wall would be built upon and added to well into the medieval period, when the wall was used to define the boundaries of the city and to control movement of the populace into and out of London. It was not until the 1700s that the decision was made to tear down the wall, as London itself began to expand outwards in every direction. Today, there are only small pieces remaining, including the one you see here, the only reminders of a powerful fortress that surrounded our capital city for over 1,500 years. Take yourself back onto the steps and walk up the second flight to your right. This brings you to Tower Hill Underground Station, and this is where your tour ends. From the scars of the Second World War at St. Clement Danes to the foundations of Londinium here at the Roman Wall, you have now traversed 2,000 years of London's history. If you've enjoyed your City of London tour with us and wish to take another self-guided tour, please visit our website at www.freetoursbyfoot.com. There you will also find self-guided tours of Roman London, Westminster, the East End, and more. You will also find information on other audio tours that we offer and our full tour schedule. Free Tours by Foot offers pay-what-you-like walking tours on a daily basis here in London, and we'd love to have you join us. Simply book online. Thank you for touring with Free Tours by Foot today, and we hope you've enjoyed every step of your journey.